From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
New blood versus old guard, the Democratic Party's way forward. I'm Todd Purdom, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. Hillary Clinton's stunning defeat left the Democratic Party out in the cold, not only in Washington, but all over the country. What's the party's best path back to power? Should it tack left to neutralize Donald Trump's diehard supporters? Or should it reclaim the centrist stance that helped Bill Clinton lead it out of the wilderness a generation ago? Ideology's not the only issue. Is the party establishment just too old and tired? Is it time for a new generation of leadership? Later, on today's Talking Point, we'll take a look at Stephen Miller, the provocative Californian who's emerged as President Trump's hardline point man on immigration. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. In a moment, we'll discuss the Democratic Party's growing ideological and generational divide and its implications for the 2018 midterms and beyond. Then, on today's Talking Point, we'll focus on Stephen Miller, the key Trump advisor driving the White House's latest hardline stance on immigration and the so-called Dreamers. But first, this news update. Devastating wildfires have swept Northern California. More than a dozen people have died since Sunday night, with more than 150 others missing. Some 1,500 structures have been destroyed in one of the most damaging single days in the state's fire history. Here's Santa Rosa Mayor Chris Corsi describing the scene in Sonoma County on NPR Today.
It traveled 16 miles in an instant, it seemed like. It just came roaring over the hills, down through some dry brush, hit one of our most expensive housing subdivisions in the hills, went through a commercial area, burned down a couple of hotels, a couple of nice restaurants, hopped over a six-lane freeway, roared through a Kmart shopping center, and then into a middle-class neighborhood in the northwest side of town.
We're joined now by Jeremy Siegel, host and reporter for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks.
You spent Monday night on the scene in Santa Rosa. Tell us what you saw.
I saw smoke, and more smoke. I spent the beginning of my morning actually down here in the San Francisco Bay in Oakland, and you could just smell the smoke from here. And as we made our way up towards Santa Rosa, the sky just got darker and darker. And once we got into town, we just saw devastation. There were flames all over the sides of the roads. We saw communities entirely burnt to the ground, and there was just smoke everywhere in the sky.
These fires have been in four principal counties, right, including the heart of wine country and Knapp and Sonoma, but also Mendocino and Yuba counties, something like 73,000 acres in all, forcing the evacuation of 20,000 people. Is this the biggest fire you've had up there in quite a while?
Yes, it absolutely is. Talking to people up there, they say they've never seen anything like this in their community. And right now, about 27,000 people in the area are currently without power. People don't have cell service. They're struggling to communicate with each other. And they all just seem baffled. And like you heard the mayor saying earlier, it just swept in incredibly quickly. There were people who were sleeping in their homes and woke up to police knocking at their doors, pulling them out of their homes and telling them that they have to evacuate. I spoke to one man, Robert Adubato, who lives at Journey's End, a mobile home park in Santa Rosa, one of the lower income areas that the mayor was referring to in his press conference. He was telling me that he was woken up by the police at about 3:30 a.m., pulled out of his unit, wasn't able to grab his wallet, wasn't able to grab his hearing aids. He's 82 years old. He's hard of hearing. And when he returned to his mobile home park later in the day, he saw that his home was gone, and 90% of the other units in that 160-unit mobile home park were completely gone.
The pictures you took are so devastating. Did everything that was burnable burn in some of those areas? So in effect, even though the fire is not under control, there's no more fire left in those areas.
It seems like most things that were burnable did burn. Although when we were at the scene yesterday afternoon and last evening, there were just still structures that were just completely in flames. And one thing that we noticed is as we were driving, there were many structures that there was just nobody around. You would just saw we were near the Hilton Hotel. And there was a restaurant out there that was completely engulfed in flames. Wow. And there wasn't a firefighter presence. And that, of course, is not because the firefighters in the area are not working hard to put out these fires. It's that they need to prioritize putting out buildings where they are worried that there are people there and that lives could be lost.
So yes,
we just saw countless structures still burning and just completely engulfed in flames.
We're talking with Jeremy Siegel of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Jeremy, when we think of wildfires in California, we so often think of the Malibu coast or isolated canyons or the edge of national forests where people are living kind of on a knife's edge. These residential neighborhoods were right smack in the middle of a suburban area. It's very unusual for wildfires to go sweeping through those kinds of neighborhoods, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's part of why the community members there were just so surprised by what happened to them. Going through the downtown sort of suburban area of Santa Rosa, it was just home after home after home, completely burnt to the ground. People didn't have time to get their cars out of the area, so there were just gray and black and even melted cars. The flames were so hot that we had metal on cars just melting. But it really was quite an incredible and devastating sight to see homes in these residential areas and places like Kmart and the Hilton Hotel just completely burnt to the ground. So yeah, it's not like other fires that I've reported on in the past, in that this one, it's in a place that is heavily populated and we see a lot of homes lost.
We know Vice President Mike Pence has been in the state this week. Is there federal help on the way for this situation?
Yes. So actually, just a few minutes ago, we saw tweets coming in from Vice President Mike Pence saying that President Trump has approved a major disaster declaration for the region, which essentially means that they
thank you so much, Jeremy. We have to go now. That's Jeremy Siegel of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco on the devastating wildfires in Northern California.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point. Donald Trump's unlikely rise has divided the Republican Party in obvious and often bitter ways. But the Democratic Party is grappling with internal tensions at least as profound. Hillary Clinton's new memoir, with its sharp words about Bernie Sanders, has reignited last year's Democratic primary feud and raised new questions about who should lead the party in the future. And the fight's not just about ideology. Here in California, Dianne Feinstein, already the oldest member of the Senate, has just announced that she'll run for a fifth full term next year. If she serves all 6 years, she'd be 91. The party's most prominent liberal faces, Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, are both eligible for Medicare. Is it time for a new generation of leadership on the left? Here's Representative Linda Sanchez of California calling for a changing of the guard.
I think that it's time to pass the torch to a new generation. They are all of the same generation. And again, their contributions to the Congress and to the caucus are substantial. But I think there comes a time when you need to pass that torch. And I think it's time.
We're joined now by Gabe DeBenedetti of Politico, who's been covering these intra-party tensions. Gabe, welcome to The Point. Gabe, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sure. I just wonder, what do you make of this situation? Are the Democrats headed for a civil war? Is there any way for them to avoid it?
Yeah, well, there's certainly a great deal of disagreements, and you could definitely call it a civil war that's been brewing for a very long time. The question is what it's actually going to look like in practice. There's no doubt that there are parts of the party that disagree with each other, and as you've pointed out there, there are people that think it's time for a new generation of leadership. But what's important to note is that there are a number of different fronts that this so-called war is playing out on. There are people who want the party to go further to the left, and there are people who want a new generation of leadership, but those are not necessarily mutually exclusive things, yeah, or things that always go hand in hand. As you pointed out, both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are hardly a new generation of leadership. So it's a complicated situation right now. There's no doubt that the Democratic Party has a lot of very big questions to ask itself.
The obvious immediate front is next year's midterms. How is it beginning to play out in state and local races around the country, this tension?
Well, it's not in enormously violent ways, shall we say, yet. Obviously, the biggest place where we might see a Democratic primary in a statewide place, in a statewide location, is likely to be California, actually, with Feinstein announcing re-election. It seems likely that she might get one or two progressive challengers. That said, it's pretty striking that it hasn't happened in more places yet. Obviously, there have been some folks who have said they might jump in against other sitting Democratic senators, but most of the incumbent Democrats have so far been able to say, well, they're just going to run for re-election without a challenge from the left.
California is one of the states where there are some potentials for Democrats to flip House districts in particular, right? What do you think the early line is on how this feuding in the Democratic Party will play out in terms of Democrats recapturing the House?
Well, the House is actually a very interesting place to look right now because, as you point out, there are a number of places where Democrats have real opportunities to flip seats from Republicans. But in a number of those districts, what we're actually seeing is a number of different Democrats jump in. So I think Republicans are kind of hoping that there are going to be really messy primaries in a lot of these seats. We haven't seen it yet, but it does seem likely that a lot of these seats are going to be facing pretty crowded fields. And so we are going to see some pieces of this Democratic civil war play out in some of these districts, whether that means a redux of the Bernie versus Hillary fights of 2016. Many Democrats hope that's not the case because that was obviously pretty uncomfortable, yeah, and some of those scars are still raw.
Let's get some perspective from the trenches from Quentin James, who's a founder of Collective PAC, a political action committee that supports African-American candidates and other progressives around the country. Quentin, welcome to The Point.
Thank you for having me.
What are you seeing on the ground in terms of where the party's future is? And tell us a little bit about some of these interesting races like the recent mayor's race in Birmingham.
Yeah, you know, I think the challenge isn't so much where, you know, the party is headed in terms of progressive versus, you know, corporate alliances. I very much think it's really around turnout. And can the Democratic Party inspire, you know, the Obama coalition, as we call it, to come back out and vote in strong ways in 2018? We saw a 10-point drop off from voters in 10-point drop off in Black voters in 2016. And so, you know, I think our question really is, you know, who are the candidates and the leaders who are going to inspire the Obama coalition to come back out and vote for Democrats down the ballot?
Are there any candidates, potential candidates, you're particularly excited about? Here in California, there's been a suggestion that Barbara Lee might challenge Senator Feinstein. Is she the kind of person you think would carry that torch?
Well, look, I think there are a ton of candidates, Barbara Lee being one of them. I think the work that Congresswoman Maxine Waters is doing around the country has been inspiring a new generation to, you know, follow her and to come back out and, you know, support Democratic causes. I think we need bold voices. And not voices that are, you know, really timid and afraid to get out there and kind of champion policy changes. And so I'm very much excited. We have a ton of candidates around the country running in, you know, contested and targeted House races. There's a woman named Darlene McDonald, a Black woman who was challenging Mia Love in Utah, for instance. You know, who would ever think there'd be two Black women running for Congress against each other in Utah, of all places? And so I think there are some amazing opportunities if we kind of expand our thinking in terms of, again, what will inspire turnout versus these kind of ideological changes that I don't think are on the minds of voters around the country.
I'd like to bring in Matt Bennett, who's a co-founder and a spokesman for Third Way, which is a center-left think tank. He's a veteran of the Clinton White House and of General Wesley Clark's 2004 presidential campaign. He believes the road back to the White House lies somewhere squarely in the middle. Matt, welcome.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
What do you think would happen if Senator Feinstein had to face a serious challenge or a pesky challenge from someone like the state senator pro tem and state senate pro tem in California, Kevin DeLeon? Would that be bad for the Democratic Party, a bad thing for the future?
Yes, I think it, particularly at this moment in history, because we have, as Democrats, as progressives, we have before us really an existential threat to our values and to everything that we hold dear in the form of Donald Trump and the Republican majorities. And every minute and every bit of energy and money that we're not using to get rid of Donald Trump and Republican majorities is a mistake and is not only wasted, but is really we're firing in the wrong direction if we're firing at each other. And if we look at the example of what happened to the Republican Party in 2010 when they fought internecine battles instead of picking the strongest candidates, that is an object lesson for Democrats, and we should not follow their example.
In terms of the races they lost.
Exactly. They had what are everyone agreed were winnable Senate races that they lost because they nominated people that were just out of step. And even in the races that they won, they were expending resources they could have used elsewhere. I'm glad they did it, but I don't want our party to follow their example.
Quentin James from Collective PAC, I'd like to ask you, I think most political analysts agree that for better or worse at the moment, for the last, you know, generation or so, the United States is a sort of a pretty squarely center-right country. You point out that African-American turnout fell off with Secretary Clinton last year. She wasn't able to deliver the proportion that President Obama had twice. If the party goes too far to the left, does it risk alienating middle of the road, particularly white voters, older voters, that usually are necessary to win presidential elections?
Well, I think your premise is wrong, right? I think when we look at the country's voters, sure, you might say the country has been center-right for the past decade or so. But, you know, the challenge is in terms of the population, folks who are eligible to vote, I would think the country is more center-left, progressive. And so the sole challenge here, again, is around turnout. You know, if the Democratic Party is going to be a party that wants to expand the ballot and fight back against voter suppression around the country, we're going to have to change our message and also change our leadership. But if we want to be a party of the past and only focus on middle of the road, middle age, you know, white America, then you're right. You know, the party should not abandon its current kind of, you know, policy platforms and its current leadership. I don't think that's the future. I think our future really is dependent on us motivating and inspiring, again, I mentioned the Obama coalition to come out and vote. And the only way you do that is to, you know, be a champion on issues and not to be afraid to be progressive.
Gabe DeBenedetti of Politico, how do the Democrats on the Hill see this situation? Are they divided? Are they fractured? How's this debate playing out among the people who are actually in office in Washington now?
Well, there's certainly always going to be divides. The Democratic Party on the Hill, both in the House and in the Senate, are not monoliths by any stretch of the imagination. But what we are seeing is a bit of agreement that what they're trying, what's important to be doing right now, for the most part, is focusing their fire on Republicans and on trying to stop the agenda of Donald Trump. That said, when it does come to turning to 2018, you are seeing some dissenting voices. We did see Congressman Ro Khanna, for example, of California yesterday saying that Senator Feinstein, his own senator, should be primaried. So there are some dissenting voices that are saying, listen, we can't simply let the, you know, focus all of our energy on Republicans. We have to, in their minds, you know, fix ourselves. So there is a little bit of a dissent, but the reality is that the vast majority of discussion among the lawmakers on the Hill itself, well, that's tactical, and they're talking about how to stop the Trump agenda before they're talking about anything else.
Where's the money going? Who which sort of candidates are energizing the donor base of the Democratic Party? Is it the establishment folks, or is it some of these newcomers on the left?
It's interesting, actually. A lot of both sides have gotten a lot of money, but it's pretty telling that the establishment people have gotten a lot of small dollar donations as well. What's been really telling, though, is that some of the bigger institutions like the Democratic National Committee have not been getting as much money as they want to be getting right now. And instead, a lot of the people, a lot of the groups who are orienting themselves as resistance groups to Donald Trump, that's where a lot of the money is going to. And what we've seen so far in some of the special elections that have happened this year is that immense amounts of money are pouring to some of the candidates who position themselves as anti-Trump figures. So that's where a lot of the Democratic grassroots is right now.
Matt Bennett of the Third Way center-left think tank and Quentin James of Collective PAC, a left-leaning political action committee, I suspect there's at least one thing on which you agree, and that's maybe it's time to rethink some of the modalities of campaigning, especially the heavy use of expensive television advertising in this age of social media. Is that something that you think needs to be rethought, Matt?
Oh, without a doubt. I was shocked in 2016 that the candidates did as much television advertising as they ended up doing. And I think now that it's coming out in this kind of very seriously terrible way about the impact that Facebook had through, you know, foreign interference, I think people are starting to recognize the unbelievable power of social media. So my guess is, you know, my generation of political people have been told this is the last cycle that television will play this kind of role for the last 20 years, but I think that may actually be true.
And Quentin, what do you think about that? One of the problems has always been, or one of the criticisms, is that the political consultants who produce these ads get a hefty cut when they run on the air. Is that a sort of a self-dealing industry that needs to take a look at itself? Quentin James, are you there?
Yes. No, I'm sorry. I think one of the challenges on the left, again, is you have this really small group of mostly white men who are, you know, controlling not only the political consultant class, but also are the kind of first step to talk to some of the best and biggest donors. And so you have this really small circle of people making, you know, decisions that really impact the entire country and the entire Democratic Party. And so, again, you know, I think not only should we change our strategy in terms of TV and put more money talking to voters, both online and in person, you know, through new digital technology. But I also think we have to change our leadership, not just in terms of folks who are in office, but also folks who are, you know, running consulting shops and making decisions in terms of the large Democratic and progressive organization.
Matt Bennett, in late 1991, an Arkansas governor named Bill Clinton jumped into the Democratic race when a lot of people thought George Bush was unbeatable, the first George Bush. And he had a determined approach to recenter the Democratic Party toward the middle. Is there somebody out there in the country that we're not thinking about right now that we should be thinking about, that we should be aware of, who's plotting a comeback?
The answer to that is I hope so, but I can't give you a name at this moment. I will say to your point, Todd, that's exactly right. Clinton got into the race as an enormous underdog, not only in the face of George H.W. Bush, but Mario Cuomo, who was the expected front runner in the Democratic primary. Obviously didn't end up running, but he was the kind of heir apparent that the Democrats had been looking towards, and Clinton faced overwhelming odds when he first got in the race. My sense is that there are a number of people out there. They may be governors. They may be non-political figures. You know, Trump has meant that anybody can be president as long as they're over 35 and born in the United States. So we're going to have a huge field, and I just don't know at this point who is going to carry that banner, but someone will certainly emerge to do so.
Gabe DeBenedetti of Politico, are politicians who are baby boomers or, you know, someplace older than millennials, do they really understand social media, how to use it, how to grapple with the questions of Facebook in the age of Russian meddling and things like that? Or is this a whole new area that they need to be brought up to speed on?
Well, there are some who are pretty good at it. You look at someone like Senator Cory Booker. He's obviously a bit younger, but he's certainly acts like a Twitter native. And there are a number of senators who have sort of been training themselves recently on trying to get better at this. But it's an important question that not just Democrats, Republicans are also dealing with right now, which is that this is an entirely new media environment that voters look at and that obviously is subject to all sorts of interference. So it's not just a question of age. I think it's a question of political culture overall. And this is actually closely related to the question of whether television advertising is the most important kind of advertising from here on out. We are seeing a broader shift here. I'm not sure it's generational or technological, but it is just a new way of campaigning. And for a lot of these senators and governors, it's a new way of thinking.
Thanks so much. That's Gabe DeBenedetti of Politico. We've been talking with him and with Quentin James and Matt Bennett. We'll be back in a minute with more on this topic. Later on our Talking Point, we'll take a look at the hardliner behind President Trump's immigration wish list. Who is Stephen Miller? This is To the Point from PRI. I'm Todd Purdom, back with To The Point. We've been talking about the Democratic Party's growing internal divisions. Does it amount to an identity crisis? We're joined now by Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Welcome, Katrina.
Thank you, Todd.
It's good to have you with us. So, 8 years of President Obama's leadership left the Democratic Party diminished not only in Congress, but in state houses, state capitals, city halls all across the country. Arguably, the country's as red on an electoral basis as it's been in many, many years. What's the road back for the Democrats from your perspective?
So there's a lot about, you know, the left's war of mutually assured destruction and internal fights. I think Democrats have been remarkably unified in resistance to Trump. The mobilization of movements and in the Democratic legislatures in the House and Senate have been unified in against the effort to repeal Obamacare, against the Republican budget more. I think Democrats would be brain dead and without a pulse if they didn't have a major debate about the way forward. It will be a generational struggle. Humility is in order. The Democratic Party under Obama lost state houses, lost state legislatures, governors' mansions. But there is a fight underway to think anew about how to mobilize people, what the Democratic base means, how to rebuild local and state power. I do think Democrats are going to have to change their message, the way they raise money. You were talking to Quentin James about the way they reach out to their base, the way they seek to mobilize and inspire voters. And I come down also to movements, not politicians, drive this debate. Our media tends to personalize political debates, Sanders against Clinton, Sanders Warren against Booker, Harris Cuomo. And there'll be fights ahead, no doubt, in 2018, 2020 around people. But I think the debate, again, is largely driven by movements, activists on the ground, and a new set of issues like Medicare for all, criminal justice issues, tuition-free, higher public ed, that are challenging old leaders and entrenched ways of doing business.
Katrina,
think it's a time of turmoil in that way, and it's healthy.
I just want to ask you, what do you make of the seeming paradox on the generational question, which is that some of the most liberal voices in the party are older voices, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren. Does that in any way undermine the notion of trying to find a fresh approach, or does it not matter how old someone is if they have good ideas?
Well, Todd, I am looking to assign a writer to do a piece on thinking about age in politics, and also struck as one watches, you know, the Vietnam series. You know, it used to be don't trust anyone over 30. We are now in a new era. You know, again, I don't over-personalize it. What I think is that in Bernie Sanders, you know, and others in movements and activists and other political figures around this country in Washington, people are taking on, whether they're 25 or 75, a failed political establishment. I mean, and the energy, ideas, and activist base of the party is coming from a kind of, you know, progressive, healthy populism, I would argue. Too often populism gets rewritten as only reactionary. It's not. And I come back to the issues. You've covered politics for a long time, Todd. You know how worthless a Democratic Party platform can be. But on the other hand, some of those issues in there, like tuition-free college, 15 minimum, Medicare for all, which is now a fight, which, by the way, many who may run in 2020 signed on to when Bernie Sanders introduced it a few weeks ago. So you had a cross-section of ages. I do think the changing media landscape is an important one, not just for the reasons you discussed with Quentin. It's generational, but it's also about diminishing the power of that political consultant media industry, which has gripped the political field because of money, and also brought in donors. And if you can reduce the cost of races and speak to millions of people and get beyond the establishment gatekeepers, even with all the problems we're learning about how Facebook operated, Bernie Sanders' campaign was propelled and fueled by his ability to get beyond a traditional establishment media, which didn't give him a fair shake. So I think there are new openings. And what excites me is not so much the special elections we saw this past year, but really going local, municipal, mayoral, city councils. Chakwa Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi, a mayor of Birmingham, Alabama. These are progressives who are running in new places and new parts, and I think give hope to a new kind of politics.
Well, that was certainly Karl Rove's strategy in turning the Texas Republican Party into a powerhouse, starting at the local level and the judiciary and so forth. Quentin James of Collective PAC, at a time when President Trump is so polarizing on the questions of race and ethnicity and has struck such repeatedly divisive notes, are the Democrats doing enough to attract and energize African-American voters? Are they willing to have a head-on discussion on race in the way that, by the end of his time, President Obama seemed willing to do?
I don't think so. You know, when we look around the country, not only are our candidates, you know, but the activist question, you know, many of these activists are seen as pariahs when they are actually the wind behind, you know, our political leaders' back. And so I think that there has to be an investment of not only resources, but of just listening and bringing folks into the fold. This is a huge opportunity for, you know, African-American political power right now. Next year, we have at the moment 6 African-American candidates running for gubernatorial seats around the country in Florida, Georgia, Maryland, Massachusetts, out in Kansas, Oklahoma. And so the opportunity to elect African-Americans to governor's mansions has never, you know, been more prime than now. And so we need our party to invest in those candidates' campaigns. The same thing on the congressional front. Next year, we have the largest class of Black candidates running for Congress in our nation's history. You know, will the DCCC and DGA get behind those candidates, or will they go out and try to recruit, you know, blue dog, older white men, Democrats, to run in those seats? That is an essential challenge and question that we have to face. And right now, we're not facing that challenge.
Matt Bennett of the center-left Third Way think tank, do you have any hope about some what would make a kind of a good candidate? Is there a prospect of these younger Democratic, say, veterans who might appeal to a broad swath of voters and kind of refocus the party in that way?
Yeah, there's no doubt. And look, I agree with Quentin. I think we have a very exciting crop of African-Americans running. We have other non-white candidates that are running. Emily's List has reported that they've got something like 16,000 women who have come forward to run for office at every level, which is phenomenal. And much, much bigger than they've ever had before by orders of magnitude. So there are a lot of candidates out there who are really exciting. Congressman Seth Moulton, himself a veteran, has a group of veterans who are running in for House races around the country who are all excellent. In particular, there's 8 of them that are running in very competitive districts. So I agree with both Katrina and Quentin that we've got some real opportunity here to change the way the party looks and elect some real new voices that we desperately need.
Katrina, ever since the Ronald Reagan era, there have been times when the Republican Party has been bitterly divided over litmus test issues, what Senator Al Simpson of Wyoming used to call saliva tests. Is it, is it appropriate for the Democrats to have a saliva test on progressivism? And what would the bright line be? What do you think the issue the party really should rally around, number one, would be in your book?
Let me step back and just reframe that, if I could, because I think what has been lost in 2016 is this debate now going on between, like, pay more attention to working class whites or identity politics. I think the analysis is simplistic, Todd. I think economic justice and racial justice aren't competing. And when did the working class become white? It's a, you know, as Stan Greenberg has said, the Democrats don't have a white working class problem necessarily. They have a working class problem. So I think economic justice, racial justice are, you know, if are tests of a character of a candidate. And I think I'd build out from that, and I'd say this is not as sexy, but democratizing democracy. You know, we've heard a lot about how Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. We need to rewrite the rules. We got rigged rules, and I think that's a litmus test for Democrats. If we don't have a level playing field, we're not going to get very far. The suppression of the vote is a nullification of the vote. It is growing. And that will be a real problem. I think there were 14 or 16 states which had new voter suppression laws on the books as we headed into 2016. And, you know, one thing the progressive movement should think about is dismantling the Electoral College. I mean, that's a legacy of another time. And so there are a lot of those kinds of issues, systemic issues, which aren't as sexy, but will contribute to not only building a progressive infrastructure and mobilization, but helping elect people, because we got a lot of obstacles at different courses along the road.
Matt Bennett, do you think the Democratic Party has done enough of an autopsy to really understand what went wrong with Hillary Clinton's campaign last year? In her own new book, she acknowledges fault, but she mostly blames external factors, from the Russians to James Comey. Do you think there's any consensus, even an emerging consensus, in the Democratic Party about what actually went wrong and what needs to be fixed?
I don't think so, and I doubt that there ever will be. I do think that there needs to be a closer look at the things that are relevant going forward. We're going to have to leave it to the historians and to Bob Mueller to sort out what happened in 2016 and what the consequences for that ought to be. But But in addition to kind of cybersecurity things, what we really got to focus on going forward is why did enough people, not a majority of voters to be sure, but enough people vote for Donald Trump to make him president? That should bring any party up short, and we need to think that through. I think one of the principal things that Democrats need to really think through, and I certainly include my organization and everybody that we work with in this number, is what was the Clinton message and why did it not resonate with enough people, in particular around economic issues. And we've been doing a lot of thinking about that. We've been traveling to all parts of the country to listen to people about what's happening in their communities and how the economy is affecting them. And I think more Democrats need to be thinking things through from the bottom up before we head into 2020.
Quentin James of Collective PAC. Donald Trump came out of the blue as a political figure. He is really the first person in American history to have not been a military leader, to have been in politics, he had no political experience before he came to office. Do you think that the Democrats should try to find candidates who in fact come from other walks of life and maybe are new to the political system but have something they can bring, whether that's community activists in the African-American community or business people? Or what's your feeling about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we should be trying to recruit folks without political experience. I think we should have a system that allows for those, you know, leaders to emerge if the voters want them to, right? And I think that's the goal. Right now on the Democratic side, I don't know if that's a possibility. You know, what I do know, though, is that, you know, if we look at 2008 when we had Barack Obama kind of come out of nowhere on the national stage, you know, Donald Trump was a kind of, you know, reaction to us having our first black president. And so on, you know, our side, we have to understand that, you know, voters are going to want a response from a Donald Trump presidency. And that may not look like a traditional Democratic candidate that we've had in the past. And so I do think our eyes should be open to new, exciting, inspiring ideas, because those type of candidates will inspire the base of the party to come back out and vote. You know, and to respond to the last question, you know, this thought of, you know, there being a central economic challenge, you know, I think there are also some racial undertones to the last election where a number of black voters either opted to vote third party or, you know, didn't vote at all, you know, both not for president, but also not voting in general. And so I do think in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, there were opportunities lost, not solely on this economic argument, but also on issues of criminal justice reform and us having a bold vision for what we want our candidate and our country to look like.
Katrina Vandenhuvel of The Nation, you seemed to suggest a bit ago that these internal divisions are not only natural and healthy, but in some ways potentially productive. Are there any bright lines the Democrats should avoid to, you know, keep from snatching a defeat from the jaws of victory, as they so often seem able to do? Are there some things that all Democrats ought to be able to agree on?
Well, there is the saying, Todd, that when the left gets into a circle, it's a circular firing squad. I'm opposed to those kind of circles. I think healthy debate, civil debate, as best as is possible in an age of social media, is very important. And I think what happened in 2016 was a kind of healthy debate where a Bernie Sanders insurgent campaign pushed Hillary Clinton to take positions she might not otherwise have, and has moved the Democratic Party. I will say, in picking up on your question, I think it was to Quentin, about there are a group of people coordinated by the chair of the largest caucus in the California Democratic Party, Karen Bernal, who are going to put forth an autopsy in early November in the belief that, you know, after a kind of train wreck, investigators scrutinize the causes and a rigorous inquiry into looking at what happened, not just in 2016, but in terms of moving the party forward. And in doing so, I think we will witness new leaders. I mean, the party not only needs new ideas, which, as I said earlier, I think could come out of a party, sadly, in the wilderness, a moment, as the right did many decades ago, advancing bold ideas, taking risks. But there are some very visionary elected officials. I think of Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, Ro Khanna of California, Ilhan Omar in Minnesota. So there are people who are emerging who are younger, who the party needs to make room for. And there will be some tension in that for sure. But there is more of a bench than I think is understood by a more mainstream media, whatever mainstream media is these days.
Matt Bennett of Third Way, is part of the Democratic Party's problem that so much of its agenda, progressive agenda, really over the last 50 years, and if you go back even further since, you know, FDR, has basically succeeded? Dwight Eisenhower preserved the New Deal, in essence. Richard Nixon created the EPA. Even Ronald Reagan, you know, by the modern lights, would be unelectable in the Republican Party because of his acceptance of the basic, you know, infrastructure of society as envisioned by the Democratic Party. Is it paying the price for that success in a way, and does it need to figure out what the next frontier is?
I think that's a really good question, and I think probably there is something to that. Obviously, we're paying a price for one bit of success with Obamacare, which started off very unpopular and cost us a lot of political power. Now that's turning around, mostly due to the mistakes made by Republicans. But I think every time you score a major success, particularly in sewing together a social safety net or an administrative state that we think is vital to kind of tame capitalism, then you are going to pay some political price for that. However, I think we are now at the dawn of a brand new age, or kind of in the midst of the change to a brand new age from the industrial age to the new economy, the information age, and that is every bit as disruptive to Americans as moving from agriculture to industry was. And that means government is going to need to change in ways that we can't even envision yet. And I agree very strongly that Democrats need to be big and bold and new in the way they think about those things, not just taking 20th century ideas and making them bigger, but coming up with brand new things to help Americans grapple with these huge changes.
Well, there's plenty to chew on, and there's plenty we're going to see starting before you know it, because, you know, there are already some declared presidential candidates for 2020. We're certainly going to be seeing these fights play out in the congressional races next year. A warm thanks to Gabe DiBenedetti of Politico, Quentin James of Collective Pack, Matt Bennett of Third Way, and Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor and publisher of The Nation, for grappling with some of these questions today. Will you come back and talk more about it in the future, I hope? Thanks. We'll be back in a minute. Who is Stephen Miller, and what does he want? This is To the Point from PRI. I'm Todd Purdom, here with today's Talking Point. In Donald Trump's often chaotic White House, Stephen Miller, his strategist and communications advisor, has emerged as perhaps the scrappiest survivor. This week, Miller's hand was seen in the president's tough new demands for immigration reform as a condition for protecting the so-called Dreamers, illegal immigrants brought here as children. Just weeks ago, Trump had seemed to signal he was open to a bipartisan deal, one that might even delay construction of his promised beautiful border wall. But the White House's latest hard line seems to make that unlikely. We're joined now by Lisa Mascaro, a Washington reporter who covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
What should we make of the White House's latest position on immigration reform, and how should we think about it in terms of the deal that seemed to have been, you know, struck in outline, at least, or at least an agreement to try to work on an agreement between Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and the president? Is that just all dead in the water now in Congress?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's too early to say it's dead in the water. What we saw from the White House on Sunday evening was this massive list of priorities from the administration on what they would like to see in a deal. Democrats have sort of derided it. One congressman said yesterday it was a Breitbart Christmas wish. You know, it was some of the really strict kind of hardline immigration proposals that we've heard in the past. And as you say, really different from what seemed to emerge from that dinner meeting just a few weeks ago between President Trump and the Democratic leaders, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, Senator Chuck Schumer, when they came out of that meeting and said they had sort of a handshake agreement on a more modest proposal that would take care of the DACA issue by providing some sort of, you know, renewed legal status for the Dreamers through probably the Dream Act in exchange for sort of a more modest border security proposal. You know, what that would be was sort of still to be determined. What now the question is was this laundry list that the White House unveiled Sunday night, a sort of must-have to-do list, or is it sort of, as some Republicans were saying last week before it was released, more of a sort of menu of options? Sarah Sanders at the White House, the press secretary, just this afternoon seemed to open the door that it is perhaps maybe a negotiation, a sort of starting point in negotiations. But that's really where it's going to hit. Does the White House dig in and it wants this long list of, you know, border security, interior enforcement, end of, you know, different immigration.
Extended family members, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And we'll see. Because that, you know, you've heard Democrat and Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill say, even just most recently last week at a Senate Judiciary Committee, that that is sort of comprehensive immigration reform and too much to sort of put on the backs of these young immigrants, the DACA recipients, you know, these 700,000-800,000 young people who stand to lose, you know, their legal status in just a few short months here if Congress doesn't act, and sort of trying to negotiate some, you know, big, bold, comprehensive immigration reform in that short time, you know, just is not doable.
And are we right to see Stephen Miller's hand in this new approach? You've profiled him dating all the way back to his days at Santa Monica High School here in Los Angeles, the greater Los Angeles area, where he was a lone sort of standout conservative in a sea of liberals. How did he come to these views, and why does he have the president's ear so strongly?
Right. This is sort of vintage Stephen Miller in these proposals, much like folks might remember the president's travel ban at the start of the year that, you know, sort of drew protesters out to airports across the nation. This is really the product of Stephen Miller, who has shown himself to be, you know, one of the most lasting members so far of the Trump administration, and someone who continues to have the president's ear. Stephen Miller is well known here in Washington, especially for those of us who cover Congress, because he was a top aide to now Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Then a senator from Alabama.
Exactly. And, you know, so how did this young man from Santa Monica, California, you know, one of the more liberal enclaves in the United States, end up, you know, working for Senator Jeff Sessions and taking this very hardline approach against illegal and legal immigration? And that was a question I had when I went to sort of write that story at the start of the year. And, you know, Stephen Miller really sort of was formed during his views were really formed during his time in the late 90s, early 2000s, as a teenager at Santa Monica High School in the greater Los Angeles area, as you say, when he was really stood out as a contrarian, someone who held these very sort of what we would call today nationalist views on a sort of concern over budding diversity, political correctness, a worry that all the rise of newcomers and immigrants to the United States were not assimilating. And then that was really punctuated by the 9/11 attacks. He was, I think, a sophomore or junior, I'd have to look back, when the 9/11 attacks hit. And it just really cut to the core of, I think, his concerns about national security and his concerns about assimilation. And that led him on a road, led him sort of into the hands of, or into the arms of Steve Bannon at Breitbart News. And, you know, after college, during college at Duke University. And
where he really defended the lacrosse players who'd been accused of rape, right? And he was a sort of an outlier there too, but turned out the case collapsed.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, some people sort of brush this off as, well, he was just a contrarian and he just likes to spar and likes the debate. And I think he most certainly does. Again, those of us who cover Congress, have been on Capitol Hill, you know him as someone who enjoys the fight and enjoys sparring. But he's also someone who I believe has these very deep rooted views on you know, what we've seen in this nation in the, you know, past half century with the, you know, we're on track to become a minority-majority population in just not much longer here. And I think that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And he sort of reflects that view. Students who knew him at Santa Monica High School, you know, really watched that. And they talk in hindsight now as adults working, you know, how people were sort of stunned to see him rise to the president's side side. But they say that you could hear those views being formed back at the high school when he, you know, demanded that students, you know,
say the Pledge of Allegiance.
And he was very critical of some of the bilingual education, diversity programs that were celebrating diversity. You know, that was a time in California really, across the nation, too, this growing sense of, you know, embracing diversity and celebrating multiculturalism as the country was going through, you know, what we now see is this sort of, you know, enormous demographic shift.
We're talking with Lisa Mascaro, a congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times in Washington. Lisa, what do your Democratic sources tell you about how they're going to respond to this latest White House laundry list of demands? Are they going to ignore it and try to go back to negotiating directly with the president, as Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer did? Are they going to wait and see what comes next? Are they just kind of in a wait-and-see mode?
Well, what I can tell you is it really looks like right out now the Democrats have sort of flat out dismissed and are ignoring this list of demands. They say it's completely unworkable, dead on arrival, not something that will be negotiable. And they know that there are some Republicans who feel the same way. What I think Democrats really see here and advocates for immigrants is an opening. President Trump really wavered on what to do with the DACA recipients. You know, he said on the campaign trail he was going to end the program, and then he kind of didn't, right? And he said a lot of nice things about the young people. He's met with them. He said they're great kids. He'd like to do something nice with them. And Democrats are trying to sort of seize on that opening and appeal to that side of Trump and try to drive a sort of wedge between the president and his hardline staff led by Stephen Miller. And you know, you heard in their comments yesterday, Democrats just dismissing this as the Stephen Miller list and not what President
Understood. Trump really wants. We thank you so much, Lisa Mascaro of the Los Angeles Times, a congressional reporter. We've been talking about the latest wrinkles in immigration.
Thank you.
To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.